Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This episode contains material that may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
What triggered this bizarre behavior? It still remains a question why he goes back to this cottage with a gun and starts threatening them, pretending to be a police officer.
In 1982, when Iceland's tourism industry was in its infancy, two French sisters arrived in the country, intent on experiencing an unconventional adventure. While hitchhiking in South Iceland, however, the women's journey took a harrowing turn. They accepted a ride from a man posing as a law enforcement officer who drove them to a remote hut in the desolate expanse of Skeiðarársandur, a vast region of black sand. The ensuing crime, marked by erratic behavior, violence, terror, and kidnapping, seemed to expose the unforeseen perils forever lurking within human nature.
It changed this innocent Iceland. This would be like a scene from a horror movie. Killer on the highway and picking up young girls. That case became infamous here in Iceland. It was a scary one.
You're listening to Nordic Crimes, Murder on the Sands.
In a country of just 320,000 people, it's inevitable that during the day you'll bump into someone to whom you're related, perhaps even closely. But how close do you want to get?
In our opening episode, we briefly alluded to the smallness of Iceland. With around 380,000 residents, Iceland's population is roughly the size of the city of Leicester in England or Tampa, Florida in the United States. Although the demographics have shifted over the past years, with immigrants currently accounting for approximately 16% of the total population, up from 8% in 2012, Iceland remains a relatively homogeneous country. The distances between people are short, which also has a lot to do with how closely related the Icelanders are. There's a news story that pops up every once in a while in foreign media concerning a mobile app, The Book of the Icelanders, designed to, as one outlet phrased it, prevent natives from committing accidental incest.
By simply bumping two phones together, you can find out exactly how closely you're related
and avoid potentially embarrassing situations.
Tim Friend, Al Jazeera, Reykjavik.
Stories such as these tend to overstate the case, but there's no denying that the Icelanders are closely related. The smallness of Iceland, its relative homogeneity, and the close-knitted nature of its community may also pose something of a challenge to local crime reporters. Here's Sigursteinn Másson, Iceland's leading crime journalist, whom we met in our first episode.
The smallness of the society, it has an impact, because I have been looking into, I guess, all in all, some like 60, 70 cases, and done programs either for TV or podcast for audiobooks. A lot of people have been involved in those cases directly or indirectly, who maybe would not necessarily want those cases to be talked about or to be dealt with the way I do. And that is understandable. I'm not necessarily creating many friends by doing this. And that's not my motive either. But absolutely, there are people who would rather prefer that I was not doing that sort of a programming.
The story you'll be hearing today cuts to the core of some of these questions. During the research phase of this episode, we reached out to two individuals connected to the case, both of whom were unwilling to go on record. The second individual to whom we spoke, a person whose phone number was listed publicly, actually encountered the suspect during his perpetration of the crime.
"So, you're gonna dredge up this case again, are you?"
the man replied. And our team has been sitting with that question ever since. Where does a line between journalism, entertainment, and exploitation lie? We put this question to Sigursteinn Másson.
In many of those cases, particularly when you have individuals who regret sincerely what they did at some certain point in time, mistakes that they made, I understand that they don't want to participate in talking about it again and dealing with it again, covering it. I understand it very well. And I think, you know, there has to be this, understanding and patience and caring for those individuals. And there are people like that in almost every case. But then I think it is also important to think and to explain that this sort of a sentiment and hurt because of the past, it won't go away by itself or just by, you know, maybe talking about it with a psychologist. You have to revisit the pain, you know. And I sincerely believe that in many cases, and I have certainly experienced that with the Geirfinnur and Guðmundur cases and many of the other programs I made, that this sort of a holistic approach is therapeutical in itself if people open up a bit and go through it in a sort of a constructive way. But of course, not everybody are ready to do that. And there is this attitude in some media that Iceland is too small for such a programming, but I would absolutely oppose that view, because I think rather that Iceland is too small not to have such programs, because the other option is to have a sort of a gossip and wrong ideas or limited information about what happened, what really happened. But I think it's very important, particularly in a small society, to stick to the facts.
We'll be diving deeper into some of these moral questions at the end of our episode. For the case you'll be hearing today has not faded from history. Besides being the basis for a TV episode produced by Sigursteinn Másson in the early 2000s, it has also, partly at least, inspired a novel and a fictional TV series. It, like many other high-profile cases across the world, seems destined to be dug up again and again and adapted to the format du jour. And now, on to our story.
What got you interested in this, the murder in Skeiðar og Sandur initially? Do you remember what?
Yeah, I mean, very dramatic case. Extremely dramatic. I was a kid when I heard this story on radio. I remember following it, those days that it was covered by radio and TV. And this, I mean, the horror was so great also, I think, because this was something that people had never heard of in Iceland, happening to Icelandic girls or Icelandic women or Icelandic people, you know, traveling in the country and just coming across a person like that who does something like this.
On December 2nd, 1981, the Minister of Transport established a three-person committee tasked with writing a report on the economics of tourism in Iceland. The report opened with a brief preamble outlining the quick growth of international tourism following the end of the Second World War. The trend was such, the authors noted, that no government could afford to go without a clearly defined policy. The authors observed that since 1935, tourism in Iceland had grown 20-fold. A meager 3,853 tourists had visited Iceland in 1947, compared to the over 82,000 expected to visit the country in 1982. Despite this growth, the infrastructure was primitive. Here's Sigursteinn Másson.
Iceland was at that time beginning sort of to understand that tourism could become something important for the economy, although it was at its very first stage. There was skepticism, you know, why would anybody want to come here?
1982 marked something of a watershed moment in Icelandic tourism. It was the year that Iceland's first tourism officer was hired and the year that the country's first tourism association was founded. It was also, on a somewhat less upbeat note, the season of many bizarre news stories. That year in Reykjavik, a German florist was murdered after he tried to take advantage of a 28-year-old Icelander. It was the year that the first press conference by a group of Icelandic inmates was held, so as to advertise the release of the album Prison Bar Rock, and the year that a young woman's hands and feet were bound in an office building in Reykjavik. She had met a man at a restaurant and invited him back to her office. The man had spotted a box of undisclosed items that he desired, and when the woman refused to let him take the box, he decided to tie her up. Later, suffering a pang of conscience, the man phoned the police, who subsequently traced the call and placed the man under arrest. In line with a certain awakening that was occurring within Icelandic tourism, 1982 was also the year that the airline company Icelandair came under fire for an ad campaign that it ran in Sweden. The campaign seemed to insinuate that persuading Icelandic women to partake in an orgy was an easy affair. Next to a picture of three blonde women wearing a single wool sweater, like Siamese triplets, the ad copy read, "Now the fun begins in Reykjavik, Icelandair's mini vacation. More than a weekend."
Yeah, not a very pleasant place, Iceland, at that time, I think, in the 80s.
Among those travelers who visited Iceland in 1982 were two French sisters, Mary Luce and Yvette, who were 29 and 21 years old at the time. They arrived in Iceland on May 26 and were among the 3,000 to 4,000 French tourists who came to the country that year. More so than other tourists, perhaps, the sisters invested considerable time in getting to know Iceland's people and culture.
Contributing to Iceland by volunteering on a farm, and had been spending a long time in Iceland with a great respect and a love for the country.
After nearly 3 months of traveling, during which time they had been employed at a fish freezing factory in the Westfjords for 3 weeks, the sisters came to the town of Djupavogur in East Iceland on August 15, where they spent a night at a local hotel. On the following morning, they planned to hitchhike to Skaftafell, a preservation area just south of the Vatnajökull Glacier that became a national park in 1957. It was about a 3-hour drive. In the early 80s, hitchhiking had become a more accepted form of travel in Iceland. Among tourists, its chief appeal owed to the fact that there were so few car rental businesses operating in the country.
And then young people with probably much less money than many of those who would come to Iceland and choose Iceland as a destination would have now. If you come to Iceland today, you know it's one of the most expensive countries in the world, along with Japan and Switzerland and Norway, so you bring with you a credit card. But at that time, it wasn't.
An article published in 1981 noted that hitchhiking was, quote, not a difficult way to get around. That is, if the hitchhiker possessed the requisite initiative and courage. The article provided several pieces of advice, the first concerning manners.
The hitchhiker should be polite and should not expect to be driven farther than the driver's destination.
The second concerning patience.
With a little patience and a little imagination, the wait for the right car is usually not long.
And the third advising a certain sense of foresightedness.
Setting expectations and drawing up backup plans is important.
Finally, the author of the article recommended that travelers be conscious of the element of danger inherent in hitchhiking.
The hazards of hitchhiking in Iceland are not significant, but in this country, as in every other country, there are certain untoward people. But not much can be said on that account. The Icelanders are mainly a very obliging people, that is, if they decide to accommodate hitchhikers.
On the morning of August 15, Mary Luce and Yvette Bahoud hitched a ride from Djupavogur to the turnoff leading to the town of Höpp, nestled in the southeast corner of Iceland. Eager to reach their final destination of Skaftafell that same day, they decided to linger on the side of the road, hoping to hitch another ride. The afternoon clock ticked towards 5 p.m. A green Mercedes-Benz pulled over to the side of the road. In the eyes of the sisters, the car, fitted with antennae and lights, and a sign attached to its roof, seemed to resemble a police vehicle. The driver, who was alone, looked as if he were in his 40s, had chestnut-colored hair, and seemed quite proficient in the English language. His name was Gretar Sigurður Árnason. The sisters told the man that they were on their way to Skaftafell, and the man told them to hop inside. Mary Luce sat in the passenger seat, her sister Yvette in the back. During the ride, the sisters discussed their experience traveling around Iceland, and the driver claimed that it was his job to ensure safety on the roads. He seemed to suggest that he worked with the police. The sisters told him that they knew of a rest hut not far from the Glacier Lagoon, where they would later stop to take pictures. When they finally arrived at the rest hut, however, they discovered that it was occupied. They visited another hut, about 4 or 5 kilometers east, but again, there was no room. It was then that the driver told the sisters about another hut, on the way to Skaftafell, that was worth a visit.
He lived at Hof in Öræfasveit, so he drives them a bit further, quite a bit further actually, into the empty sand and suggests that they should be comfortable there.
Between the Skeiðarárjökull glacier and the sea, there's a vast expanse of black sand. The name of this sand, Skeiðarársandur, is the source of the English geological term sandur, meaning an outwash plain formed by glacial meltwater. This sand was ground down by the glacier from which it takes its name and carried by glacial rivers that flow into the sea. Among them is the Skeiðará River, which proved the most difficult obstacle in the construction of Iceland's famous ring road. The Skeiðará River itself was not bridged until 1974, and the original bridge, which was 904 meters long, was destroyed by water and blocks of ice during the last major glacial outburst flood in 1996. The bridge was immediately restored, but all that remains of the original structure today are 2 twisted girders by the side of the new road. At around 8:30 p.m., the sisters reached their destination in Skeiðarársandur under the drizzling rain. The driver escorted them to the doorstep of the rest hut, a small, unassuming shed, and helped them unload their luggage. He explained that the hut was owned by shepherds, but that travelers were welcome to use it. There were no lights in the house, and the driver tried to turn on a heater that was resting on a table. He stayed only briefly and neither demanded, nor was offered, payment for his services. Soon afterwards, he bade farewell, without mentioning any intention of returning. After the driver had taken his leave, the sisters settled down for dinner and engaged in conversation. Mary Lou's composed an entry for the guestbook, where she thanked the, quote, sheriff for all his help. At around 9:30 p.m., they decided to retire to their beds, opting for the lower bunks and a pair of bunk beds. Yvette chose the bed closest to the door.
They go to sleep early in the evening. They're going to continue early in the morning. On their way to Reykjavik, they have a flight a few days later back to Paris.
But at 11:30 p.m., their slumber was abruptly interrupted.
Then suddenly they wake up with a noise, and there is Grettir back.
He was carrying a gun in one hand and a flashlight in the other, which he directed inside the hut. Standing in the doorway, he announced his intention of taking the sisters to the town of Hup, near the turnoff where he had picked them up earlier that day. He told them that he had been ordered by the police in Akureyri to arrest them because they had been smoking hash.
He is demanding that they step outside, and he is accusing them of smoking cannabis and things like that.
Taken aback, the two sisters denied the man's accusations, and although the man did not appear especially worked up or under the influence of drugs or alcohol, Mary Luce and Yvette were unsettled by his demeanor, but eventually invited him to search their luggage. The sisters then demanded that the man show them his badge, for they had begun to doubt that he was an officer of the law. Flashing a rather dubious document, the man repeated his demand that they come along. The sisters once again refused.
Then he goes. I think basically they kick him out. Like, for sure they responded to him, you know, what a ridiculous claim, you know, we are not smoking cannabis, and leave, please leave, you know, or something like that. He goes back to his car.
Meanwhile, Mary Luce and Yvette dressed themselves and began packing their bags in a hurry. When the man returned, he was still carrying the gun, along with a roll of plastic tape or wire, which he threatened to use to tie the sisters up. When they continued to protest, the man grew angry. He went back to his car and returned carrying a large stone or metal object.
He attacks Mary Luce.
He struck Mary Luce 3 times with the butt of his shotgun.
While the other one escapes, runs out of the cottage.
Shortly afterwards, a truck driver drove east along the ring road and came upon the turnoff to the rest huts. He noticed the green Mercedes-Benz parked slanted on the side of the road. The lights were on and the engine was running. The driver was standing next to the car. As noted in an interview with a truck driver in the newspaper Morgunblaðið,
"The man was standing next to his car, and I stopped my truck and rolled down the window, which was when I heard a panicked scream from a young woman. I asked the man what had happened, and he replied that he had accidentally struck the woman with his car in the darkness. That's when the girl emerged from behind the vehicle and groped her way towards my truck. She grabbed hold of the bumper, pulled herself up the steps of my car, and clutched onto the side mirror. She yelled, 'Please help me, he tries to kill me,' and then kept repeating that statement. I asked the man what the hell was going on, and he told me that she was dazed following the collision and entreated me to go get some help. When I started to pull away, the young woman refused to let go of my truck. I instructed the man to pull her away from the car so that I wouldn't run her over. He did, and the woman continued to scream incessantly. I drove away, and the last thing that I saw was that the man was holding the young woman near his car."
The driver noted that he was not inclined to question the man's story, as the Mercedes-Benz was marked with the words "road assistance" and branded by the Icelandic Automobile Association.
Absolute nightmare scenario. And then you have this episode with the driver of the truck.
Did you speak to the driver for your episodes?
I recall contacting him, but again, or my assistant, but without luck. And the same with Gretar. We also contacted him.
The truck driver arrived at a service station in Skaftafell, where he told a local ranger that a car accident had occurred on the ring road in Skelarosandur. The ranger immediately called the police. As the truck driver was coming upon the green Mercedes-Benz on the ring road, Mary Luce was lying unconscious inside the rest hut. When she finally found the strength, having heard screams, gunshots, and an engine turning over, she climbed to her feet, wrapped herself up in a sleeping bag, and walked through the darkness towards the road. Some time passed until she spotted a car coming from the east, from Skaftafell. But fearing that the car might belong to the man who had attacked her sister, she hid behind a large rock. When a car finally came from the other direction, Mary Luce ran onto the road and waved it down. It was a police vehicle, driven by the officer that the ranger had notified. Mary Luce was taken to Skaftafell, where a doctor from HUP tended to her wounds. She was flown to hospital in Reykjavik later that night. On the night of the sisters' assault, search and rescue teams were dispatched to find the driver of the green Mercedes-Benz. The search bore no results. It wasn't until 10 a.m. on the following morning that two police officers discovered the vehicle near a gravel pit by Havrafell Mountain, not far from Skaftafell. Yvette's body was in the trunk of the car. It was cold and perforated by 5 bullet wounds, believed to have been fired from a .22-caliber rifle. Magistrate Fridion Gudrodarson told reporters about the discovery.
It's not until 10 a.m. that we'll find the vehicle near Havrafell, and in its trunk, the body of a young woman, the other sister, which has suffered injuries and bullet wounds.
Has the man been found?
The man is not found, and it's probably still carrying the rifle. We can't find it in or around the car. The Coast Guard has dispatched its helicopter and is still combing the area. The rescue units arrived last night from HUB alongside the police, and they've kept guard of the area. Given that people are quite nervous in approaching an armed individual whose actions are unpredictable.
The police also requested the aid of a sniffer dog. The dog sniffed the vehicle and then headed in the direction of the Svínafellsjökull Glacier near Havrafell Mountain. It led the authorities to a crater, which was where the man was initially believed to be hiding. But as the sun descended towards the horizon, and no trace of the man was found, the day's search was called off. On the following morning, the search was directed west of the path that the sniffer dog had cut in the hills of the glacier on the slopes of Havrafell Mountain below the Itluklettar cliffs. Snorri Magnusson, with a rescue unit from Hafnarfjörður, alongside 2 others, noticed that several stones appeared to have been loaded near a big boulder by the entrance of a cave. It resembled a fortified shelter. Snorri decided to check it out. And it was then, at around 10:30 a.m. on August 18th, that the man was discovered.
The first thing I said to him was, "Aren't you cold?" And then I told him that I was going to take his rifle, because the cops had told us about it. And so I stretched in between the stones to grab the rifle by the butt, and that's when he grabbed its barrel and began to tug. And then he said, "Be careful." And I asked why, and he told me that it's loaded. And I said, "All right, just let go." So I grabbed the rifle and unloaded it.
But Gretar was carrying more than just a rifle.
And then I looked back, and I saw that he's holding a shotgun. We hadn't been informed about any shotgun, and he must have intended on defending himself because he'd lined up the pellets so that he could easily load it. But he just handed it over and walked with us towards the vehicle.
When questioned if he had asked the man about the murder, Snorri replied no.
But he did say, "Don't worry, boys, I'm not going to shoot you. And then he added something about the whole thing having been an accident, or something to that effect. I don't remember how he phrased it exactly.
The man was cold and sluggish. When asked if he had been afraid, Snorri said no.
It happened so quickly. I didn't see him until I peeped inside the shelter, and suddenly we were standing face to face. I was just relieved that we had found him.
The man made no protest when the authorities arrested him.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
During his initial interrogation with the police, Grettir confessed to the crime. His recollection of the events was similar to the story that Mary Luce had told. However, he maintained that he had fired an accidental shot inside the rest hut, which the authorities would later dismiss as unlikely. He was actually asked to accompany investigators back to the rest hut so that he could reenact the events. The investigation concluded that Grettir had intentionally fired the shotgun twice at Yvette, whether near the rest hut or the ring road, and the autopsy identified the cause of death as gunshots from a distance into the woman's back. It ruled out the theory that asphyxia from being placed inside the trunk of Grettir's vehicle and the concomitant panic that caused contributed to her demise. Grettir was sentenced to 16 years in prison, but released in 1993. As noted by Sigursteinn, the real motive behind the murder has never been revealed. Grettir claimed that he had driven to the rest hut because he believed that something was happening inside the hut as he drove past it. The police found, however, that given the darkness, it would have been impossible for him to see what was going on from the road. They also found nothing to suggest that the woman had been smoking hash, having interviewed several individuals who had met the sisters on their trip around the country. No one reported anything unlawful.
This argument that the murderer came up with and the reason for what, why he did what he did. He said that they had been smoking cannabis. This was just a made-up motive, for sure. Possibly there was something in his mind for a time, but it still remains, I think, a question why he goes back to this cottage there in the middle of the the desert, basically, or the sand, with a gun, and starts, you know, threatening them and making a civilian arrest, pretending to be a police officer and all this. You know, what triggered this bizarre behavior of his, and whether it was his motive all along to, well, if not to kill them, but to at least threaten them and frighten them later on when he drives them to this this cottage, and he chose the cottage, you know, far away from everything. It was not their idea to go there. So it seems like that he had already planned something, also given the fact that he lies to them about being a police. I think in the early 80s, you know, you had demonized already 10, 15 years before, you see that in the Geirfinnur and Guðmundur cases, demonized people who were smoking cannabis. You know, that they were terrible people who deserved everything bad, you know, basically. That was what happened in the 70s. And you have some remnants of that in the 80s as well.
Furthermore, a report by a forensic psychologist noted that Grétar was not suffering from a mental illness, mental deficiency, or neurosis, although he did have a personality disorder. Quote, "His emotional life is superficial, and he is extreme in his beliefs." The psychologist noted that Grétar had also been struggling with alcohol abuse.
My name is Ragnar Jónsson, and I'm a detective chief inspector of the crime scene and forensic unit here in Iceland.
Ragnar is Iceland's foremost expert on blood pattern analysis. We'll be getting to know him better in later episodes. Over the past two decades, Ragnar has investigated the crime scenes in nearly all of Iceland's most high-profile cases. Recently, given the distressful nature of his work, he sought to transition from policing to screenwriting. The crime series Black Sands, which Ragnar co-wrote, was partly inspired by the tragic events on Skeiðarársandur.
It changed this innocent Iceland. This would be like a scene from a horror movie. Killer on the highway and picking up young girls. That case became infamous here in Iceland. It was a scary one.
As previously noted, the murder of Yvette has not faded from history. Besides inspiring the TV series Black Sands and Sigursteinn's TV documentary in the early 2000s, it also partly served as an inspiration for the novel Missing, written by crime writer Stefán Máni. Stefán Máni wanted to distance his novel from the events on Skeiðarársandur because, he acknowledged, such cases are sensitive. In 2018, the New York Times published an essay by 17-year-old Rachel Chestnut, one of the winners of the magazine's student editorial contest. Her essay, entitled "Is True Crime as Entertainment Morally Defensible?", noted that, quote, "real-life acts of violence had long been masqueraded before the public, whether as crime pamphlets or investigative documentaries, but that the genre of true crime had only recently risen in prestige."
Delving deeper into real tragedies and revealing them to the public has its benefits, such as reevaluating botched or unjust criminal trials and allowing viewers to think critically. Unfortunately, these advantages are outweighed by the genre's tendency to exploit suffering, lean toward a preconceived narrative, prioritize ratings over morality, and manipulate public opinion.
To delve into some of the moral issues of true crime, we spoke to criminologist Margrét Valdimarsdóttir.
I wanted to ask you a few questions about true crime. I know you're a fan of true crime podcasts and TV shows and the like, right?
No.
No?
No. So, no. Okay. No, I mean, I no. The issue I have about true crime podcasts and shows is, yes, I do watch them. because I want to, because people are interested in them and they want to discuss them with me. But the drama sometimes bothers me.
As a criminologist, I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts? Should we be reporting on these past crimes in this manner?
Well, the creators of those podcasts should be aware that this isn't really educational. I mean, going in depth into one case is really interesting, especially if it's an old case. It can tell you so much about the culture at the time, at the what society was going through, especially if you look at the reporting, news reporting, how was the case being discussed, what, even, you know, what kind of words were used to describe the offenders, the victims, you know, how has it changed? All this is really interesting. But if you want your podcast or your true crime show to be really, really popular, I mean, the best way to do this is to add some drama to make it exotic, which is usually, the more exotic, the more drama is usually less from the truth, because crime is complicated and just sometimes just not that exciting. But now that I'm saying this, I do remember some both podcasts and true crime shows that have actually made a difference, that have made people open their eyes to especially misuse of justice in the criminal justice system or some unfair treatment. So if people hadn't actually just taken old cases, and independent filmmakers or people working in the media hadn't just taken on their own these cases and just broadcasted them, no one would have cared. So I'm contradicting myself now that I think of this, because this is a really important issue. As long as something gets popular and some attention, changes are often made. And this has been, I'm thinking about the Central Park Five, for example, and there are many other examples of, where people were treated really unfairly in the criminal justice system. And we wouldn't have known that, and nothing would have changed if it wasn't for true crime shows and podcasts.
In the year 2000, Seusdet Mauchon visited Mary Luce in France during the production of his TV show on the events in Skeler og Santur.
It took some time to find her, and it took longer time to earn her trust and confidence. And she was not very keen in the beginning to go through this again and to talk about this again. She had made, her life there in the countryside as a farmer, basically, bee farmer, making honey. And she has this really, really nice honey shop in a small village there outside of the city of Nantes.
What is striking about Seustedt's interview with Mary Luce is the latter's magnanimity.
She had, I think, come a very, very long way in forgiving and at ease as much as you can be with the past. That was really fascinating to learn.
Despite the unimaginable pain that she suffered during the summer of 1982 in Iceland, Mary Luce appeared to have forgiven her sister's murderer.
And I think I learned from her more than anybody the power of forgiveness. Because the forgiveness was not about this Gretar guy, basically, although she forgave him totally for what he did. The power of it was that it released her from a big part of the pain and the anger, particularly. that was something that, that was a revelation, I think, for me. So it was a really moving you know, educational experience for me as a program maker to meet her and to talk to her.
Did it change the way you approached cases in the future or the way you thought about what you do? Or?
I don't know if I if it did, but it certainly, I think, taught me, you know, whatever you go through, how important this part is, the forgiveness, and that until you reach that point, that you are sort of a prisoner yourself in all the terrible you know, situation you have encountered and has been brought about on you. You know, you are a prisoner of it. You know, you're a victim. And with the forgiveness, whatever it is, you know, with the forgiveness, you are losing. You know, you're taking it, the burden, you know, largely, not totally, but largely off your shoulder.
Nonetheless, it took Mary Luce a long time to forgive Iceland.
It took her a long time just to forgive, basically, Iceland, you know, just to accept that what happened was not, you know, something that happened because it was Iceland or something like that. And it's very understandable that, you know, when you have such a horrible experience that you distance yourself also from the place, from the country where it happened. And that is what she did. For sure, the biggest lesson from this case is the lesson of sort of a reconciliation and forgiveness. By far, that is the biggest message after this, because if she can forgive, who cannot? But I think another... there are always other lessons. It's like, you know, there are warning signs normally blinking before something like this happens. And there were warning signs in this case.
Sigursteinn is alluding to the fact that prior to killing Yvette, Grétar, among other things, had behaved in a threatening manner a few years before, so much so that the police in Akureyri had confiscated a firearm.
A person who is showing immoral behavior is lying about who he is and who he is representing and his authority. He should not continue to be representing a national organization like the FEBA.
That's the Icelandic Automobile Association.
So that's another lesson to learn from this. Of course, nobody could imagine that he would do what he did. There is nobody but him to blame for that. But I think there is a reason always to reconsider. Was there anything happening there that should have been addressed earlier and could possibly have prevented this? I'm not sure if the answer is yes, but I mean, I think it is important in always to at least ask those questions.
We asked him what labels he applies to a person like Grétar. Was he evil?
I'm not sure if we are necessarily born good. I think we are born with all sorts of elements, good and bad. We can see that with little children, you know, the greediness and... you know, how far they are willing to go to get what they want, you know. We have all sorts of elements in our nature, you know, good and bad. I don't think that there are many people that are totally bad or completely immoral. Probably there are a few, but I think that's not a big number of people. But it depends a lot on the values that you grow up with and the caring and the support that you have as a child and a young person, what comes on top, the good part or the bad. And when you have on top of that maybe like a lot of drinking you know, a lot of abuse of alcohol, like that also sort of brings more forward the bad side, you know, and can lead to a very strong immoral side or behavior. And I think that is what happened in Greta's case.
Are you a forgiving person?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of an elephant, you know. It can be hard for me sometimes to forgive. If I feel that people have, you know, sort of chosen to, people who should know better, you know, because they have the intelligence and they have the maturity, should have it, and behave really, really badly toward others, then it can take quite a while for me to forgive that. But I think by talking to Marie-Louise and sort of not only hearing her words about it, but sensing it very strongly from her, this total unconditional forgiveness to the murderer of her sister, that I think has maybe encouraged me further to forgive, but I have a long way to go, you know, in comparison to Marie-Louise.
This episode was written and reported by Ragnar Thomas. Producer and sound designer was Eirikur Sigurdsson. Executive producer is Nils Bergman. Nordic Crimes is a Tall Tale production. Please rate, review, and recommend the show to friends. Your support helps us reach listeners who might also appreciate the content. Thank you in advance.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.